Welcome to the Wyoming Catholic College distance learning class, Points of Light in the Darkness, the Church in the 19th Century. I'll be your professor. I'm Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at the college. When he accepted the 1988 Republican presidential nomination, George H.W. Bush famously said, quote, "For we're a nation of community, of thousands and ten thousands of ethnic, religious, social, business, labor union, neighborhood, regional, and other organizations, all of them varied, voluntary, and unique. A brilliant diversity spread like stars, like a thousand points of light in a broad and peaceful sky." A thousand points of light was one of Mr. Bush's key themes, something for which he was viciously criticized and mocked. Yet a thousand points of light has been and continues to be the right solution for our country and for our church. After all, from the beginning, it has been God's preferred strategy. Who were the Israelites? Point of light in a very large world. "Do things without murmuring or arguing," St. Paul wrote to the Philippians in chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, "so that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation in which you shine like stars in the world." Despite the title of this series and despite its contents, it's not a history course. I'm not a trained historian. My doctorate is in Christian spirituality, looking in particular at the dynamics of renewal and revival. And while that makes me a student of history, my concern is to tell the story of renewal and revival in the 19th century. And here's the reason. I want us to consider how Catholic renewal and revival can unfold in the 21st century, across the world, in our country, in your diocese, in your parish. That is, my purpose is vision and hope for today. And I think we can accomplish that by looking at what God did during the 19th century. The Catholic Church at the dawn of the 19th century looked as though she was on the ropes at best, and at worst, down for the count. Historian John Laurie wrote, quote, "The French Revolution had displaced the faith in post-Bourbon France and seen churches padlocked to be reopened as temples of reason, as eight bishops and countless priests and nuns were murdered. In 1797, Napoleon Bonaparte was beginning his machinations against Pius VI that would lead several months later to the French occupation of Rome. The 80-year-old pontiff was taken prisoner, the fisherman's ring forcibly ripped from his finger, and he died in France. Within a few years, his successor, Pius VII, was famously humiliated by the emperor at the coronation the pope was invited to attend. And in 1809, during the second French occupation of the city, was abducted from the Quirinal, where he had been placed under house arrest and taken from Rome. The tricolor replaced the papal flag over the Castle San Angelo. Pius VII did not return to the Vatican until 1814, the year of Napoleon's exile to Elba and the Congress of Vienna. With the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire in the first decades of the century, hundreds of German monasteries, abbeys, and schools were also closed. Anti-clericalism was on the rise in Spain as well, leading in ensuing decades to savage outbreaks of violence against Spanish priests." Close quote. Well, that's a nice, well, not a nice, but that is a summary of the church's situation in Europe at the start of the 19th century. Change was coming fast and furiously, far too fast and furiously for the popes and bishops of the day. They were overwhelmed. They tried to fight it, argue with it, push it away, ignore it, reason that should not be thus, and yet thus it was. And turning back the clocks was not, then as now, an option. And it always surprises me when that comes as a surprise. There's no going back, and nostalgia is a waste of time and energy. Just as the church today cannot return to the nifty 50s or some other fantasy era, the church in the 19th century could not return to the Middle Ages and Christendom. Lands were no longer ruled by feudal ties of blood and loyalty. Philosophy was no longer dominated by theism, let alone Thomism. Faithfulness to Christ and his church were viewed on a scale from optional to treasonous. In this first lecture, I want to address two colossal developments that changed the political and intellectual landscape to the point where things were barely recognizable. And those are, first, the centralization of power in the state and later in the nation state. Second, the philosophical shift from everyone finding truth in the objective outside world to each individual finding truth in the subjective inner world of his or her consciousness. Let's start with the centralization of power. St. Augustine wrote in his magisterial City of God, in the light of the destruction of Rome by the Visigoths in AD 410, by making the distinction between the city of man and the city of God. The city of God, the church, where Christ is king, is ruled by caritas. It's ruled by love. By contrast, Augustine writes, the city of man is ruled by its lust of rule, by libido dominandi, the irrepressible, sinful, and all too human desire to dominate others. The desire to make you obey my will and to sing my praises as you do it is baked into our fallen human nature. You don't need to go far outside of your own home to know that. Now, I suppose it should go without saying that St. Augustine was no dummy. In truth, he wrote, these two cities are entangled together in this world and intermixed until the last judgment affect their separation. That is, there is love in the world. Politics, politicians, nations, and empires do some very good things, and actors on all levels of the church do some very bad things. I'm very grateful to have police and firefighters. I'm happy to be protected by just laws and a strong military. Despite the problems, it's good to have public education. I'm grateful for the good people at the Wyoming Department of Game and Fish. And I'm mighty fond of the roads maintained by our local, state, and federal workers. Is it all done out of pure love? No, but these things are good things, and no doubt, at least some of them, are done out of love for neighbor. At the same time, the church is something less than the realm of pure love for God and neighbor. Sad examples abound of bishops, popes, priests, deacons, religious, and many, many lay people using the church, using ecclesiastical office, using brothers and sisters in Christ to control and dominate physically, emotionally, financially, spiritually, sexually. Now, with that in mind, let's look at the medieval era. Was this the city of God ruled by caritas? No. Did kings and princes avoid playing power politics with one another, avoid libido dominandi? No. Human nature is fallen and marked by sin, and you can't change that. Nonetheless, the medieval era was an era that understood that rule by love was the ideal. The decline and fall of the Roman Empire left a power vacuum that had to be filled, and it was filled by both secular and ecclesiastical authorities. And it's vital to point out, as Brad Gregory does in his book, The Unintended Reformation, quote, just like clerical leaders, secular authorities subscribed to, promoted, and defended Christian truth claims, whether explicitly or implicitly, in the domains of life in which they exercised power. Most of the considerable friction between ecclesiastical and secular authorities during the Middle Ages concerned who would exercise control over which areas and activities of human life, and who, in the end, rightly wielded ultimate authority and power. It was, as Pope Gelasius I said to Emperor Anastasius in AD 494, there are two powers, August Emperor, by which this world is chiefly ruled, namely, the sacred authority of the priests and the royal power, close quote. You have secular authority, I have royal, you, the secular authority, have your realm, and I, the ecclesiastical authority, have mine, and we work together. This system worked pretty well until the late 14th and early 15th centuries. By then, the church had become increasingly bureaucratized and bossy, and along with bureaucracy and bossiness came corruption, libido dominandi, utterly dominating caritas. The church smelled of simony, nepotism, greed, sexual license, and assorted other sins in high places. Many bishops never visited their multiple dioceses. Many clergy, even if they weren't illiterate, were theologically illiterate. And needless to say, if the leaders were having problems, and if the leaders were indifferent to the gospel, so were the lay people. But of course, not all lay people. Pious rulers, frustrated with the system, took matters into their own hands. Schism began in 1378 with the election of a second and then a third pope, all claiming to be the legitimate pontiff. In the midst of that, Brad Gregory writes, quote, whatever the mix of motives in particular cases, lay rulers capitalized on the clash within the church, both to strengthen their power and to assume greater control over ecclesiastic reform in the regions under their authority. Now later, with the Protestant Reformation in the early years of the 16th century, this control by the secular authorities over ecclesiastical matters and over the religious lives of their subjects exploded. In 1555, the Peace of Augsburg that ended the so-called wars of religion, they weren't really wars of religion, the Peace of Augsburg turned on the Latin phrase, cuius regio, eius religio. Whose realm? His religion. Meaning that if your ruler was a Catholic, you were a Catholic. If your ruler changed his mind and decided to become a Lutheran, you became a Lutheran. Or else. This is perhaps most obvious in the case of England. Henry VIII, while not a party to Augsburg, in 1531 had himself declared, quote, supreme head of the Church of England, close quote. Note, Church of England, not Church in England. Ongoing loyalty to the Pope was no longer permitted, as martyrs John Fisher and Thomas More came to discover. Henry's daughter, Elizabeth I, turned adherence to the Catholic Church, as opposed to the Church of England, into a capital crime. Rather than honor the king or queen as sovereign and head of the church, Catholics had a divided loyalty. That was treason. Across Europe, Rulers turned their churches into departments of government. For Holy Roman Emperor Joseph III, a Catholic, the church was, quote, a department of the police. I find that terrifying. Ecclesiastical authorities found themselves sucked into the vortex of the centralization of power in the state, a vortex that had only just begun to spin. We had arrived at something completely new, at the beginnings of the sovereign state. Scholar William Kavanaugh, in his book, Migration of the Holy, God, State, and the Political Meaning of the Church, writes this, quote, the conceptual leap that accompanies the advent of the state in the 16th century is the invention of sovereignty, a doctrine that asserts the incontestable right of the central power to make and enforce laws for those people who fall within recognized territorial borders. In pre-modern Europe, he goes on, authority was often marked by personal loyalties, owed in complexly layered communal contexts. In the state, by contrast, borders mark out a unitary space in which the individual is subject directly to the center, which has the right to enforce its will through a monopoly on the means of legitimate violence within those borders. Close quote. In the 16th century, the churches that succeeded, the Lutheran Church, Reformed churches, Zwinglian, Anglican, and Catholic, succeeded because they received state support and approval. Groups like the Munsterites, the Anabaptists, the Quakers, and others had a very bad time of it because they had no state support or approval. But state support and state approval came at a price. As Brad Gregory put it, while churches could still persuade and influence, quote, never were they in a position to force the political hand that fed them, close quote. Gregory goes on, quote, popes had no choice but to negotiate and play along if they hoped to retain some influence in regions whose rulers had not embraced Lutheranism or Reformed Protestantism. The various states of Europe not aligned with Protestantism nonetheless grabbed control of the church, appointing bishops, approving or disapproving priests, demanding that clergy swear oaths of allegiance to the state, closing monasteries, seizing their property, promoting anti-Catholic laws, regulations, and prejudices, and they also demanded a monopoly on education, closing or taking control of Catholic schools and universities, and for various periods of time, suppressing the Jesuits. The church was mocked and lampooned to the point where, as Henri Daniel Ropes notes, quote, the common people were firmly convinced that the whole church was the enemy of freedom, close quote. The state and the state alone emerged as sovereign, even over religion. More than that, the state had the responsibility to protect people from the controlling and reactionary machinations of Rome. The state needed to set them free, and too often they did it with the approval and help of bishops and priests. This sort of thing had never happened before, and though the popes of the time were no doubt good and holy men, they were on completely unfamiliar ground. They were facing military threats, and they did not know how to cope. In addition, commenting on the enemies of the church in France on the eve of the French Revolution, Henri Daniel Ropes notes, quote, they could have been resisted only by a church united, coherent, and governed by far-sighted men of unquestioned authority. But the church in France had no such qualities, nor had those responsible for her guidance, close quote. This could be said of most of the church across Europe for much of the 18th and certainly 19th centuries. This was in large measure because of a second development I want to address, The philosophical shift that brought about a dramatic change in the understanding of what it means to be human and what it means to be free. What's wrong with the world is one of the great questions. The story is told that when the great Catholic commentator G.K. Chesterton was asked to submit an essay answering the question, he simply replied, "I am." The world is a sinful mess because I'm a sinful mess, and you're a sinful mess, and everyone else who has ever lived, with a few exceptions, with a couple of exceptions, is a sinful mess. If that's true, what is freedom? Freedom is getting loose from the sinful mess in order to be fully human, fully the imago Dei, the image of God we were created to be. "For I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, in my flesh," wrote St. Paul in Romans 8, 18 to 20. "I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I that do it, but sin which dwells in me." Close quote. As a result of sin in me, I am not free. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, writing in the early 18th century, had a different idea. "Man is born free," he wrote in his essay, The Social Contract, "and everywhere he is in chains." In answering the question, what's wrong with the world, rather than Chesterton's "I am," Rousseau asserted, "Well, certainly not me. I'm fine. I'm good. I'm free until I come in contact with you. The chains are the chains of society." In his book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Carl Truman contrasts Rousseau's childhood thievery with St. Augustine's childhood thievery. In his Confessions, St. Augustine tells us about how he and a bunch of his friends saw pears in a neighbor's yard and decided to steal them. Rousseau, in his Confessions, this is amazing, Rousseau tells us pretty much the same story, only he and his friends stole asparagus. Each of them asked the same question. Why did I do something I knew was wrong? Carl Truman explains. Augustine blamed himself for his sin because he is basically wicked from birth. Rousseau blames society for his sin because he is basically good from birth and then perverted by external forces. So what do we need to do? Augustine knew we need to seek redemption. Rousseau believed we need to stomp out those external forces, destroy any society that perverts our natural goodness. Well, it was a short step from Rousseau, who died in 1778, to the French Revolution that began in 1789. The king, the nobles, the merchants, the landed gentry, traditional education, and above all, the church, corrupted human nature and suppressed human freedom. We must set people free, and if someone refuses to be free based on the standard of freedom set by what Rousseau called the general will, Rousseau's prescription was to force that person to be free. He wrote this, quote, "To protect the social contract from being merely empty formula, therefore, it silently includes the undertaking that anyone who refuses to obey the general will is to be compelled to do so by the whole body. This single item in the compact can give power to all the other items. It means nothing less than that each individual will be forced to be free. Close quote. Sound a little scary? It should. Sound a little familiar? It should. Few people today have ever read Rousseau, and I dare say most people today have never even heard of Rousseau. Yet his influence, as it was in the 19th century, remains vast. Add to Rousseau the rationalism of René Descartes, who, like Rousseau, looked inside for truth. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Because I can think about anything, I can assert that there is at least one being in the universe, namely me. What about you? What about the grass and the trees and the flowers? Do they exist? How can I know? If they exist, we'll add Immanuel Kant in here, if they exist, how can I know their true nature? Can I know their true nature? No, I can't know their true nature. I can only know how they appear to me. And suddenly, the truth about things becomes unknowable. Reality becomes unknowable. It's not something out there to be discovered. Reality is only my perception of things. Truth is my perception. Truth becomes subjective. Well, what about God and all the things the church believes and teaches? Well, in final analysis, these things are unknowable. Oh, you can believe them if you choose to, but they are by definition beyond reason and, of course, beyond science, and thus mere opinion. Yours is as good as anybody else's. As the 19th century progressed, theology would find itself rapidly demoted from the queen of sciences to a not terribly interesting or influential department in a research university with far more important things to consider. You see, the Protestant Reformation had really settled in. You were a Catholic, your neighbor was a Calvinist, and, well, you need to get along. So, what about differences in our view of the sacraments, the number of books in the Bible, the authority of the church, the exact meaning of the word justification and the phrase justification by faith? What do we do with these disagreements? We treat them as differences of opinion. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, what difference does it make anyway? And matters of settled doctrine on both sides of the Tiber and in the world around the Christian churches became something less than settled. Over time, we agreed to disagree, and then we agreed that no one really knows. And then we added more doctrines to the pile. The Trinity, the Incarnation, the deity of Christ, the Atonement, the resurrection of Jesus, the authority of the Church, the authority of Scripture, the nature of male and female, the nature of marriage and family, and the list goes on. Suddenly, it was all up for, well, suddenly, over time, it was all up for grabs. Now that was happening in the 19th century, fueled by Rousseau and others in the 18th century, and leading to Hegel, Marx, Freud, Darwin, Nietzsche, and others as the 19th century progressed. Some of you are thinking, Jim, you're simplifying what is a much more complicated story. And of course, you're right, I am. If you want a fuller explanation, let me refer you to Brad Gregory, The Unintended Reformation, Carl Truman, The Rise of the Modern Self, Henri Daniel Ropes, his books about the 19th century, the Church in the 19th century, William Kavanaugh, Migration of the Holy, and others. My concern is not a thorough explanation of how the culture of Europe turned against and turned on the church. My point is that the political centralization that led to sovereign nation states and the philosophical ideas that drove nation states to control the church when not completely ignoring her created a new world. And it was in this new world that Christians needed to respond to Jesus' great commission in Matthew 28:18-20. Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always to the close of the age." It was a new world, a corrupt, secularized, anti-Christian, even anti-church culture. But Jesus' command to evangelize and make disciples never changes. And his promise, "I am with you always," never changes either. So next week we'll take up the first of five unlikely and unexpected Catholic heroes and heroines by looking at post-revolutionary France and at St. John Vianney. From Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.